Paul. Today's show, I interview Anthony Sumaroff. Let me tell you, you are going to enjoy his accent. I sure did. He is a clinical psychologist, but he's also an investigative journalist who's focused in on pharma. We have an incredible discussion about all the things that we are deceived about when it comes to our understanding of pharma and its role in our world. But don't miss the end. We do a deep dive into, you know, what should parents do? What can we do for our children? And his clinical insight was absolutely incredible. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I'm standing outside the emergency room here in Milwaukee, Oregon. We just entered with my mom, who told me just a few hours ago, Paul, I don't know, this might be the end. She might be dying. Right now, my mom is the most important thing to me. And you know, I think this is true for all of us. Whatever hardships we're going through, we put our family first, and we do whatever it takes to be there for them and to love them. Thank you. Welcome, Anthony Sumaroff. You are a real intriguing guy to me because I read your ebook, Seven Big Pharma Myths Debunked. And then I learned a little more about your huge project, extensive critique of the pharmaceutical industry called Big Pharma, None Dare Call It Quackery. But to introduce you to our viewers, you're a psychotherapist, an economics journalist. You're the author of a book, Universal Basic Income, For and Against. You're a regular columnist at TerrainScience.com. And then, of course, you've got this big project you're working on. Fill in the gaps there. I don't know you well, so I'd love to learn more about you, your background, and what got you on this path.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul. You are such a hero to me. You know, a few years ago when I heard about your study, it was like very fortuitous. And it's something that I've often referred people to, especially in light of the fact that, you know, the CDC have been asked to do a study of this kind since the 80s and they refused to do it. So, you're a real inspiration. I've also found you and your collaborator, James Lyons Wheeler, really helpful, because when I want to talk to people, I don't like making claims I can't substantiate. So let's say, well, you could look at this or you could look at that. And I think anyone who wants to download my free ebook, Seven Big Pharma Myths, which you can get from sevenpharmamyths.com. Sometimes Americans don't understand me when I say the word myth. So that's
myths, M-Y-T-H-S. And the seven is the number seven, not the word. Sevenpharmamyths.com. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
It's a good read, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's so much to talk about, but the less said about me, the better. I was already writing about the economics of healthcare, and with the pandemic of BS falling down upon our heads, I abandoned a bunch of my projects because I was like, am I just rearranging the deck on the Titanic, the deck chairs on the Titanic here? You know, I was asking myself, what's the most useful thing I could do with my skills? And given that I'd written a lot about the economics of healthcare, and I was already on to the idea that you can reverse diseases by changing your lifestyle, because I'd done that myself, and also practicing as a counselor, a psychotherapist, I've had a little bit of an inside view on what the official channels are doing when it comes to mental health. And so I thought there's lots of, and you know, I studied philosophy as part of my degree, so critical thinking, reasoning. I've always been an economics, you know, I've written a lot of economics. I could marshal my forces and the interests of, instead of just taking this from one angle, like the terrain or the regulatory system or the economics of healthcare or the fact that they tell us that we're living longer because of pharmaceutical science, when actually we're living longer because we've got running water and refrigeration and sewers and things like that, which is one of the myths I address in the book. I wanted to give people a panoramic view. So that's what I'm building towards. And part of building towards it was putting out this free ebook at sevenpharmamyths.com. And I continue to write on Substack. But if you get the free ebook at home, I'll automatically put you on my Substack. And of course, if you don't want to follow it, you can unsubscribe very easily. But you get that would keep you abreast of what I'm doing. So that's the overview of how I came into this. I came to be focusing on that. And I would just say every day I wake up like knowing exactly what I want to do with my life. When I started writing this book, everything just clicked. You know, I see my clients and I do some writing and I've got good friends and relationships and things like that. So that takes up all my time.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit on something really important here, Anthony. There is nothing more important today in our world than to really understand what's going on. And the fact that the pharmaceutical industry has now become so powerful. And really, I think the myths that I'm going to have you kind of go through them, we were believing that they were, righteously doing this great work for us when I think, I've been living it as a pediatrician. I'm now retired, but I wasn't seeing my patients doing better, right? I've been doing pediatrics for 35 years and they're just getting worse
I'm
and
so sorry to
worse
hear
and
it.
worse. So, one of your first chapters, I think, is pharmaceutical medicine making us healthier? What have you found as you researched that?
Well, it's interesting when people talk about this because I remember having a chat around the dinner table at some point, and my sister said, "Oh, yeah, but people are living longer." And this is years ago. And I was like, But then what we find is when we actually look, first of all, there's a big blurring of the lines happening here because I don't want to. If you have a cut or a contusion, or you need a skin graft, or they need to take an organ out for whatever reason, if you've got a tumor that's impacting on your ability to move waste out through your colon, they can cut it out so you can poop, right? When it comes to emergency medicine, surgery, they can also give you hormone replacements if if you had to have an organ removed. When it comes to emergency medicine, the mainstream doctors are miracle workers. But this is where all the lines get blurred because pharmaceutical medicine isn't actually surgery, right? I sometimes think if I could give the book a second title, a second subtitle, it would be like surgery isn't pharmaceutical medicine. If we just decoupled these two, and instead of having a healthcare industry or a medical industry, people had called them two different names, like the pharmaceutical industry and the surgery industry. And then people wouldn't get so confused. Do you know what I mean? Because they really use the success of emergency medicine to make it look like the healthcare industry is getting better results as it has. If you look at all the major achievements, they've been in the area of trauma crisis care, and that is where they excel. There's no doubt about that. But here's the thing: diabetes is skyrocketing. Alzheimer's disease has never been so prevalent. When you look at dementia, which is, by the way, costs, I can't remember the figures. As I say, I don't like to say make claims I can't substantiate, but I believe it's several times what other leading causes of death are now costing society. And guess what? As a side effect of taking too many pharmaceuticals, right? So when it comes to The kinds of conditions that people tend to get, arthritis, these are just accepted as normal right now. And more people are suffering from stress, anxiety, and depression, or have acid reflux, ulcers, stomach problems. More people are on psychiatric drugs. And I have to tell you, as someone who's had people come to me as a counselor, who've sometimes been mistreated by other mental health professionals, the worst treatment they get, I've heard reported, is from psychiatrists who are not trained counselors, by the way. So, you know, so it's like when we're living longer, maybe that's in doubt, because apparently life expectancy has been going down since 2013 or 2014, but we're living sicker. And if you were to design a healthcare system that would shovel the maximum amount of money from taxpayers and workers' wages via insurance companies into the healthcare industry, I don't think you could come up with one better than this. Keep people sick for as long as possible without killing them, and treat them the whole time. That's what the system is incentivized to produce. And as an economist, we're always trained to believe that things tend to go where the incentives point. So economists are always thinking about incentives. Well, the system seems to be turning out the results that you would expect it to based on its incentives. We're getting sicker and we're spending more and more money in healthcare. And I always kind of quiver when politicians say, we're treating more patients than ever before. They like to do that here where we have socialized medicine. That's silly. If your healthcare system was successful, you'd be able to get on TV and saying we're treating less patients than ever before because everyone's getting healthier.
So you bring up a really good point there, and you're in the UK, correct?
I am at the moment. I tend to spend quite a lot of time in countries like Mexico, but I'm visiting home at the moment.
Right. And when you talk about the healthcare system there, it is socialized medicine in the sense that you would think, as you just pointed out, that the incentive would be to reduce costs by having people become healthier. And yet that doesn't seem to happen, does it?
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't happen here, and it doesn't happen in America. It doesn't happen in Canada. Interestingly, Singapore spent a quarter per head of what the USA spends on healthcare, and they deliver better outcomes. And all of Singapore's healthcare system was designed by American economists trying to fix America's system, but your government didn't adopt those policies. Singapore's government adopted them. So one of the problems is we think we have different systems. We have a socialized system, and you have a private system, even though the government pays for half of it. The US government spends as much money per head on healthcare as the UK does. But we don't have different systems. Both are systems of sickness. The only thing that is remunerated in each of these systems is the treatment of ill health. So that's basically what you're going to get. We both have the method of paying is slightly different. And therefore, some of the features of them are slightly different. For example, in America, you have insurance, so the incentive is to overtest. You have a lot of overtesting. In the UK, the government doesn't want to pay for stuff, so sometimes we undertest. You know, so there's certain features, but one thing that seems to be similar is everyone's getting sicker, and it just costs more and more money. So even though it's a different ship, the sails are pointing in the same direction.
Yeah, good point. In my world with children, and as you know, I wrote the vaccine friendly plan and then published the vaxxed unvaxxed data from my practice that was so, you know, basically shocking. The unvaccinated kids just don't get sick. They don't get chronic disease. They don't get infections as much. So if you wanted to take your health back into your own hands and focus on wellness, my data would suggest do less, don't vaccinate, eat healthy, you know, and the outcomes would be devastating to pharmaceutical profits.
Correct. And I've got a question for you, Dr. Paul. When you did this study, has anyone actually critiqued the study and shown problems with methodology? Because I see that if I Google your name, I'll come up on one website or another that says, along with this ridiculous study conducted by these two clowns, that but they never actually say what's wrong with the study. So what I'm interested, they just dismiss it out of hand. So what I'm interested in knowing is, has anyone written an article saying that there's anything wrong or criticizing your methodology?
No, it's just name calling. There was one complaint that was filed with the journal that published it, which said, well, everyone knows that parents who don't vaccinate also don't seek healthcare. So of course we would get the results that we got.
Interesting. Well,
we controlled for that in our study.
Interesting.
But the journal retracted our study anyway, just based on one complaint. They didn't follow proper procedure and allow us to have a rebuttal to that ridiculous complaint. Happy to report, we republished, not me, because I was at the time forbidden to do research, of all things, but Jack Lyons-Weiler. Jack Lyons-Weiler and Russell Blaylock, pediatric neurologist.
Oh, good for Russell. Amazing.
They published, they reworked the data, proved that actually my unvaccinated parents were seeking well child visits at a higher frequency than the more vaccinated parents. So the exact opposite of what we were being accused of was true. And they did one other thing that was very important for listeners to understand. They took a look at what happens to the children whose parents at any time stop vaccinating. Compare those kids to the parents who continue to vaccinate. And we found, which was a little surprising to me, that if you stop vaccinating, you're way better off. Like half the problems if you stop vaccinating at any time compared to those who continue. So that news there is, you know, even though you may have been following a program that you thought was wise, follow the CDC schedule or even the vaccine friendly plan, which is not friendly enough, as my data shows, you can stop the harm at any time. You don't have to keep following a schedule that's harming your child.
Thank you. And Russell Blaylock's been a big guy in evidence-based medicine and whatnot for quite a long time.
Yes, he's written he's written numerous articles about the connection between vaccines and autism or aluminum. He's somehow he's managed to stay out of trouble. I quickly got myself in hot water when I basically took a shot at the CDC vaccine schedule.
Right. And I mean, first they ignore you, but if you give them something that they can't, they'd rather ignore you. Okay.
Right.
But if they can't ignore you and they have to confront you, then, you know, it sounds like it's a lot of this name calling. I can't wait to see my Wikipedia page if I'm ever big enough to have one. It'll be good to read about things that I never even knew I'd done.
Yes. So while we were chatting about vaccines, I'd like to ask you a question about what your research has shown with regards to the general belief that pharmaceutical medicine is responsible for the disappearance of diseases like polio, whooping cough, measles, because, of course, we had vaccines for these things. And what did you find as you researched that?
Well, it's interesting because, and one thing I should point out is I love going to mainstream sources. And one thing's it, because it could be that if you go to alternative sources, you'll find out that the truth is even worse, right? But I say, even if you just listen to what the AMA and the CDC have to say for themselves, then they come down on our side. It was actually the American Medical Association that told us that most of these diseases decline due to improvements in living standard. Now it is true that we did have vaccinations for things like polio and whooping cough, but an interesting thing is, it is literally we, as in America and the United States and things like that, because these diseases also declined in nations that were not rich enough to afford those vaccines. And the thing is, I was just looking for the relevant quote there. What they basically said was that all communicable diseases declined over this period, and that includes things that that there was no mainstream treatments for as well. Lots of conditions that people used to get back then, they don't anymore. Scurvy and rickets and cholera. Well, scurvy and rickets mostly because of malnutrition. Cholera because we have access to better water. So if it was true,
tuberculosis,
also,
yeah.
Yeah. These diseases, many of these diseases declined significantly or almost entirely before the vaccines were brought out. And that would suggest that it was either because of herd immunity or because of improvements in living standards.
Yeah. Well, so, that's a really important point. I thank you for highlighting the fact this has been true. I mean, the story I was taught in medical school of smallpox eradication, giving credit to the vaccine. Well, very little of the world saw that vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and thank you for reinforcing that.
Yeah. So, and that's true for most of them.
And if you've got any other sources that I didn't mention on that, please feel free to send them my way to review, because I'm always, I already added a couple more on living standards. I'm always trying to be very robust on these core claims, because people who read first they're already on our side, but once they go up against the firing line, it's good to have a couple of official sources backing up what you have to say, so you can go, but you know, blah, blah, so that people can raise their eyebrows a bit and go, I didn't know that. And that does sometimes happen.
You made such a good point about the U.S. system for emergency, for surgeries. You know, if you're in a car accident, it's one of the greatest systems. Mm-hmm. However, chronic disease, and you mentioned and alluded to that, is just skyrocketing. I mean, right. We just had the report come out this past month, CDC reporting autism is now 1 in 36. I mean, this is a condition, when I was growing up 60 years ago, there was none. I did not ever see a single kid with anything like autism. I mean, it just was not around. And now it's, 1 in 36.
It's prevalent.
In some places worse than that. And I know in the UK, it's the same story. So is it true pharmaceutical medicine is effective and it's helping us live better lives?
Well, let me just dig out a quote from you for you. This isn't in the free ebook because I didn't know it at the time when I wrote the free ebook. What does the British Medical Journal have to say on the point of whether pharmaceuticals are effective? But the British Medical Journal told us in 2013, unfortunately, in the balance between benefits and risks, it is an uncomfortable truth that most drugs do not work in most patients. Okay, so don't take it from me. What we're seeing is basically a cascade of chronic illness, because if you don't actually tend to the body's needs, which may be the fact that it's malnourished, you can be fat and malnourished at the same time. I mean, you can eat lots of calories, but unless your body's getting what it needs to build healthy tissues, it's not got the capacity to do that. Or you've been poisoned by something in your food, the air, the water, toxic relationships, or something that someone injected into you at some point. So unless you're taking what you need to build healthy tissues, and maybe it will take a while because your organs might be damaged in their ability to assimilate that stuff. If you're dehydrated and you've got you're getting headaches because you're dehydrated, taking an aspirin is not going to hydrate you. So until we actually, here's the thing, one of my teachers said, there's no such thing as a pharmaceutical drug deficiency. There's no Prozac deficiency that's causing depression, right? So as so how can pharmaceuticals be effective at anything other than repressing symptoms when they don't actually have anything in it that the body needs to build itself anew and build healthier cells and tissues than before? The body's saying, where's your, I'm built from amino acid drugs, where's your amino acids, where's your vitamins, where's your minerals, where's your water drug? I'm made of, the body's not meant to have anything in it apart from what the body's made of. So the drug's going, I can't help you. Well, then why are you here? Well, I guess it's because the drug companies told me to be. So I think that's why we're going to find that most pharmaceutical drugs, there may be a therapeutic benefit in the short term for acute treatment while you treat the underlying cause of the disease. In the meantime, as I said, you know, there's no such thing as a drug deficiency.
Yeah. ADHD, it's not a Ritalin deficiency or an right. Adderall deficiency.
Right.
You name it. Any chronic condition is not a deficiency of the drugs we use as MDs, you know, prescribing this or that. We're treating symptoms. I had a perfect example of this. I developed a chronic rash this past year, and it was a little puzzling to me. I mean, I'm pretty good at diagnosing rashes, and this one was unusual. So I thought, all right, I better finally go see a dermatologist and just see what they have to say. Just one look at it. Oh yeah, you've got eczema, and here's your steroid cream. No discussion about what might be causing what's going on, how I might. In fact, he actually told me, well, this is just part of getting old. Your skin gets dry. In fact, it's going to get worse. There's nothing you can do about it, but just keep taking these steroid creams. Well, what I have is not a steroid cream deficiency, as right. you pointed out. In fact, I think you have a story to share of your own health that you figured out the answer. Oh,
thanks for mentioning that.
Sort of got you on this journey of understanding how to deal with root cause.
Well, eczema was a big one because I suffered from that a lot when I was growing up. And back then, I mean, the doctors didn't, I don't know, you'd have to tell me, you're more plugged into the medical world than I am. I do speak to doctors, many of them who come from our point of view and some that don't actually to get information. But I think it's widely acknowledged that some foods like dairy and gluten tend to be implicated, and maybe fried foods. Are they saying that in mainstream medicine now? Would a doctor tell someone to stop to check if they were allergic to gluten or dairy?
Only if you have full-blown celiac as far as gluten goes. And no, there's complete denial of this whole issue of delayed allergies, or sometimes I prefer to call it food sensitivities, so that people don't get confused that I'm accusing or suggesting they have an allergy. Mm. But we have the ability to test immunoglobulin G, IgG. Mm-hmm. And this is that memory arm of our immune system that... you know, you get elevated antibodies when your body sees something that is, it thinks should not be there. Well, we should not have massively elevated antibodies against gluten and dairy and other foods. And yet many of us do.
Yes. And go on.
When you test for that and you eliminate those foods, surprise, surprise, almost every single time the eczema goes away.
So I had eczema growing up. It got so bad, I got impetigo, I got infected. It was never all over my body, but up and down my whole legs and you know, as I said, I never knew anything about this stuff. I have actually reversed eczema through a combination of diet, juice cleanses, fasting, different detox protocols. That kind of put me onto it. I mean, when I went to a naturopath in the south of England, he had a PhD in medical sciences. I had a bunch of symptoms, mucus forming. I had blotching on my feet, on my chest. And he said, that will all be your digestion. So he gave me some things to support with that. And that really sent a light bulb off in my head. The doctors don't really know what they're talking about. I think that was one of my formative experiences. Another one was, I'd been told Oh, I can give you something for that, but the blotching on my feet. But the likely thing is it'll take a few months to work, and if you come off it, it'll just come back. So there's not really much point treating it. I managed to reverse that. That took a little bit longer. Early on, I remember a doctor once asked to prescribe something, and I said, "Well, I'll look like do a little bit of research online, and then get back to you." And he went, "Okay then, doctor." And that was like really, I assumed so very naively, I was quite young at the time, that he would be glad that I was taking an interest in my own health. But I thought maybe that was rare, and he'd be like, "Oh, that's great." You know, apparently that's not how doctors are educated. So these kinds of things kind of put me onto the path because I have actually had success in reversing conditions that the doctors say you can. I've spoken to a couple of people who've reversed irreversible Crohn's disease. I've spoken to people who've reversed irreversible cancer and clinicians who treat them, sometimes in Mexico, because you can't do it legally in the USA. So there's more cause for optimism than most people think.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing your personal story, Anthony. I wish more of our viewers and listeners and people out there would just realize that the pharmaceutical industry is not your friend. Unfortunately, most traditionally trained MDs are following a paradigm that is just illness causing and symptom treating and doesn't ever really look at the underlying issues. And that's where you, just as Anthony did for himself, you can start becoming your own best doctor, so to speak. Because you can figure out what's going on. The information's there. It's so funny. Us doctors, I say us because I'm an MD trained person. And we would say anybody that was looking online was like, "Oh, well, you don't want to get your information from Google or online. You know, it's just filled with misinformation." And yet, where would we go? Honestly, when we had to research something, that's the same place we would start. I mean, you might go to Google Scholar and we might go to PubMed, but anybody can go there also, right? So all the information anymore is pretty much digitalized, and that's where things are up to date. I read
Thanks
books
for seeing
too
that.
because they're a little harder to censor. Online information gets a bit censored. What do you think? Is pharmaceutical medicine safe? Because they sure act like it is. Like, this is science, this is safe. That's not my experience, but what have you found? I know you've been doing research and writing on
All
this.
right, yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I don't know, you'd have to ask why 128,000 people a year die from taking the correct dose of a pill that they were properly prescribed, or why another 128,000 a year die because they were wrongly prescribed something that was contraindicated, or because of a dosage error or so on. Why is it that 840,000 patients are hospitalized a year in the USA for being given drugs that cause serious adverse reactions? It's interesting because it speaks to the incentive structure of the system again, because they're not actually that hard to prevent. But the incentive structure of the system is such that if you get infected, you're going to stay in there longer. So everyone's profiteering from you being ill. So yeah, I mean, what I outline in the ebook, and I hope everyone enjoys it, is that there's people think that the kind of thing like Vioxx is the kind of thing that happens from time to time. But the whole system is structured in such a way as to prevent these kinds of things from being so as to produce these results, right? So it's not that anyone in the system, I'm sure there probably are some people in the system that is bad, right? That are bad, but the vast majority of people are doing their job on, they're in their little tunnel doing what they're supposed to do to fulfill their responsibilities. But the ship is sailing in a certain direction based on the incentive structures of the system and the regulator, you know, the incentives faced by the regulators, faced by the scientists who are based on everyone who has to make a profit, based on the pharma reps whose job it is to recommend doctors to prescribe their drug rather than someone else's, by the fact that it's so expensive to bring a drug to market that the pharmaceutical companies would rather tinker with the existing treatments and change them slightly so that they can patent them, etc., etc., etc. So when you see that there's been these drug scandals like OxyContin, and sometimes I report on pharma companies being taken to court and getting sued for something like scientific fraud, or saying a drug's safer than it is, or illegally advertising a drug off-label, and they get fined. This is what I mean by a bad incentive. What they get fined is a fraction of what they profited from selling the drug that they shouldn't have been selling to whoever they sold it to. So we are going to continue to see medicine being unsafe until it can, until we fix our institutions. In fact, I just put an article out today called "How Can We Trust the Science When the Journals Are So Compromised?" So I'm reporting on this, and all this will be collected in the future.
That's a huge topic. You know, as a physician who reads quite a bit, I've gotten to the point anymore that if it's published in a major journal, I'm suspicious that there's been manipulation of the study design, that there's, you know, statistical gaming of the system, and then the dishonesty that goes into so many pharmaceuticals in particular, because of the way it's set up, right? They're in charge of the design, they're in charge of the study, they're in charge of the data, and they don't have to report the raw data.
Right, exactly.
So there's just so many problems. And if you get findings that you don't like, you just don't publish them.
Right. And there's a huge problem. I think it's called the file drawer problem, which is, you just don't register studies that are unfavorable. So even if someone runs a meta-analysis and says, well, this is the best treatment with the least side effects, well, how do you know? How do you know how many studies were done but weren't published?
Right.
So, and that's reported in great detail in the book Bad Pharma by Ben Goldacre. So he talks a lot about the omission of studies that and how what you're getting is just, well, what you're getting is what's favorable to selling drugs.
Yeah. So how do we help people get back to critical thinking and to common sense? What would you suggest there?
Now, that's a big one. If you're going to open your mouth and speak to someone, make sure that you only stick to topics where you can speak authoritatively, because you've got because you can substantiate what you've got to say. If there's areas where you're not sure, you can say, well, maybe we can come back to that topic another time. And you can even say, because you can say what I say, which is, I don't like to make claims that can't substantiate. Or you can just say, I'd like to have a look into it. Stay where you know. Like, I didn't start writing anything on vaccinations until I made sure I knew enough, because it's such a hot topic. So, and you can also say, you can ask someone a question like, what evidence would be required for you to change your mind, or what would satisfy you? So that you've now got the criteria on the table for having that kind of conversation. You know, it's very funny that you're people name call and say your study is bad, but don't say why and things like that, because there's so much bad evidence in medicine. I mean, I've got a whole chapter in that in the ebook at 7pharmamyths.com. But just as an example of like some of the hijinks that happened, this was reported by Robert Whittaker famously in the book Anatomy of an Epidemic, that with antipsychotic drugs, what they did was they took a bunch of people who were already doing okay on the drug off the drug, and then they randomized half of them into what was called a placebo group, and then put the other half of them back on the drug and said, well, people really perform better on this drug than without it. Really, people on the drug performed better than people who were withdrawing from the drug. What an astonishing surprise that must come up as. And this is there. That book came out ages ago, and these drugs are still being prescribed. So I just want you, people should, yeah, I mean, you can use examples like this, and I certainly give plenty of them in the ebook. You somehow you need to kind of kick in the door with people and give them something to be curious about. And you also need to retain your own sanity and remember that you're not always going to be able to change someone else's mind. So be choicey with your words. I apologize if I've been long-winded and not that choicey with my words today. choose a couple of examples that you think are really going to stick with people, because people can't unhear something. And even if they don't get it in that moment, they'll remember it when someone says something else. So, and that's part of what I've done with this ebook, because sometimes I'd find the most shocking information on page 115 or 367 of someone else's book. And I go, wait, what? And that's the kind of stuff I try to put in straight away. Like, I just like kick the door in, get people's attention. Let's start with the big topics. And you know, it's quite remarkable when you look at, I mean, I thought I knew a lot about this stuff a year ago, but it goes so deep. So even though I've been working on this stuff for quite a while, it's still endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. I like what you said. Ask someone, what would it take for you to mm-hmm. consider mm-hmm. this information or change your mm-hmm. opinion? Mm-hmm. I'm finding in many cases, it doesn't matter what I say. It's almost like a belief system or a religion mm-hmm. as opposed to a real look at science. And right. I mean, when you hear like in the vaccine agenda or the vaccine world of research, you'll hear officials saying, well, the science is settled. Mm. Science is never settled. It's always an ongoing
Well,
look
I mean,
at the data.
If the science is settled and you're so sure, why don't you encourage the CDC to do a large study of the long-term health outcomes of vaccinated and unvaccinated populations? There's 800,000 completely unvaccinated people in the USA. It wouldn't be hard to take a sample, 10,000. Just do it. Okay, you and I both agree. We both like science. You say the science is settled. Well, then do the frickin' study. So here's the thing. People sometimes have preferences masquerading as beliefs. Okay, it's not got anything to do with what the information says. That is what they prefer to believe. Maybe just because they're a member of a group that share that belief with them, they don't want to be alienated from. I don't really know why, but there's signs when that's what you're dealing with, which is that someone will make an argument for something, and if you knock down that argument, they'll change to another argument, and then if you knock down that argument, they'll change to another argument. So the position stays the same, but the argument for that position keeps on changing. And then if you bring the topic up with them a week later, they go back to your first argument as though you never even knocked it down in the first place, right? If that happens, don't bother debating them, or at least bring it up. Say, look, we spoke about this. Well, or don't let someone go to the next argument. Just say, wait a second. Before you told me that you believe this because of argument A, now you're telling me you believe this because of argument B. Which is it? And you can even say, could it be that you just want to believe that and whatever the are you need whatever the whatever I say, you're just going to keep on changing the argument. Because if that's the case, then maybe we just shouldn't discuss this issue. But if you are if you're interested in finding out the truth, then I am interested in speaking to you. And if they go, yeah, I'm interested in what the truth is, say, okay, then how could we how could we find out what the truth is? How could we both agree? So these are, yeah, I wonder if we were taught these skills at school, if people would be more open-minded, or if people just get more and more clever at defending their positions. The more you teach them, the more sneaky they become.
Well, you bring up a good point. In school, I even right through medical school, we basically, and I know it's worse today, I'm hearing, mm-hmm. we're basically taught facts, mm-hmm. and you're tested on your ability to regurgitate facts. And I would struggle so much because I think deeper than just the yes, mm-hmm. no, or the fact. And right. so then I'm thinking, all right, do they know the information I know? In which case the mm-hmm. answer is this, mm-hmm. But I don't, that's not mainstream. So they probably want this answer. Mm. It, most, you know, when you, and this is a plea to parents, actually, mm-hmm. As you raise your kids, if you've got an argumentative kid who's trying to figure things out, you should be supporting that mm-hmm. because they're learning how to think critically mm-hmm. as opposed to do as I say. I mean, if we have authoritarian parenting and authoritative schooling, and right. then you turn out these adults and you suddenly think they're going to be thinking critically, it's probably too late.
I think you make a good point there, and you remind me of another reason why I think maybe people are so resistant to changing their minds. If you go through that school, right, yes or no answers, right or wrong answers, either you got the fact or you didn't get the fact. What happens is when you get things wrong, you get a crop, you get a D, you get an F. And maybe that creates a mentality where people are afraid to get it wrong, right? So once they have a position, they have to commit to it because they can't be wrong. People are afraid of being wrong. People get criticized a lot as kids. They get scolded, they get spanked, they get, and all of these things create a fear of error. So I think, you know, that's me putting my psychotherapist hat on, you know, yeah, your point on your plea for raising children better, I think is definitely a critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, no, good point. In fact, dig into your psychotherapist background and think about what advice you would give to parents. I mean, obviously you can extend that to adults. We need the same sort of critical thinking, but given what just happened in our world with COVID the last 3 years, where it was like pharma misinformation, censorship on steroids.
I think it's a parent should read a book called How to Talk So Kids Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk.
I like that book.
That's such an amazing book, and I had such a formative experience on me growing up when I read it, because it helped me decode all the unkind ways that I was spoken to as a child and validate my experience. So that will give you communication skills. As counselors, we're taught to summarize what the other person has said and put it back to them in their own words. And I've learned that's not just a skill for therapists. It's become incredibly useful in my friendships, in my romantic relationships, and when it comes to debating people. Because when I'm at my best, I'll stop and put what the other person has said back to them to make sure I've got it right before challenging something they've said. And I've found that it makes my conversations harmonious. These are excellent skills to develop if you're a parent. They're so important for children. And I saw this myself when, as part of my degree, I did a placement as a classroom assistant, because I've been reading all of this stuff because I was interested in it, but I didn't have any children of my own. So it was, even though I taught piano, and I dealt with children there, I got to see it at work in the school, and I was like, right, this isn't just stuff in books. This really, really works with kids. Then there's the thing that children need good adult influences in their lives. They shouldn't just be hanging around other kids all day in school or out. So it's really important as parents, you know, get good friends. Taking care of yourself is taking care of your kids, right? Because when they go over and speak to your friends, and you should have them around the house, make friends with other parents so you can watch each other's kids. You deserve a date night too. Never stop dating. You know, that they know things that you don't know, or have a different sense of humor from you, or interact with children differently. So, and they're not so worried about being a good parent to the child, so they can be a little bit more free and less rigid and just be themselves and play with the child. That is really important, and something has been lost with the move towards what we call what passes for civilization these days. In some ways, we've uncivilized. We've uncivilized when it comes to the importance of the role in community and causing harmony for ourselves, which, and by extension of that, for the children that we bring into the world. Because to a large degree, we are our children's environment.
I think our children, in this very complex, stressful world we now live in, do need to have an umbilical cord, so to speak, figuratively, mm-hmm. to their guardians, their protectors, mm-hmm. their parents, their nurturers, right? Mm-hmm. Are we cutting that umbilical cord too soon and just shoving kids off to daycare and kindergarten and school? I mean, I was very prepared for it. I was a great student. I had a lot going for me, but I went off to boarding school in Africa at age 13. And basically that was the beginning of my adulthood or my independent living. And in retrospect, I look back and thought, well, that's a pretty drastic cut the umbilical cord, throw a kid at 13 on their own. I mean, in the middle of Africa, I'm more than a thousand miles away from home, no phone calls, letters that took a week or two to get back and forth. What comments do you have for parents, in that regard, to how to continue nurturing their kids and for how long?
That's so interesting. I'm not sure I'm exactly the expert on this question, but I love the synchronicity that not long ago I was speaking to a client myself that was regaling me of how they remember every day they were crying in fits of tears when they were left at daycare. And what sparked it was I was speaking about another incident, and they were describing the feelings of sadness about that incident. And I asked a question, which is a good question for a counselor, which is, does that remind you of anything? And the thing they went back to was this thing that happened in their childhood. So that feeling of abandonment is so deeply rooted in them. They were watching the clock, and if their parents were 1 or 2 or 3 minutes late, every minute late they were, the more anxious they got. That's someone who's not ready to be separated from their parents yet. You think, oh well, you know, let them cry out, toughen them up. It's not going to toughen them up. You're making them more vulnerable. You're giving them a wound that can be, it's a button that can be pressed at any time in the future. And that will lead to them having to come to someone like me to help them get in touch with themselves and overcome the difficulties, the challenges. So one thing is that kids spell love T-I-M-E. And you really need to make quality time with your children, even when they're not children. So I would say an important thing is that when you're with your family, especially as parents, make sure you're not just relating with them on the level you can get stuck into, which is doing. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. Instructions, criticism, even praise. Oh, you did this well. You did that well. All of these things are always putting you in the position of parent role. You're performing the job of being a parent. And I understand performing the job of being a parent is something that has to be done from time to time. But A really important thing is you experience just being together, spending time together, playing, laughing, asking questions out of nothing but curiosity, taking an interest in things. You know, if they're on TikTok too much, sorry, that's another word that Americans don't understand when I say it. I'm starting to remember them all. TikTok, you know, the app that's
yes.
addictive, right? Ask them what videos are interesting in it. You know, I played video games too much when I was growing up. Thankfully, I don't, and you know, I can't enjoy them anymore. And that's been the truth ever since I, you know, got into my 20s. Thankfully, because it's such a time sink. It would have been so good if one of my parents or an adult had said, "What are you playing there? Show me. Why don't you teach me how to play it? Find something your kid's good at and get them to teach you how to do it." Right?
Yeah.
All of these things are ways of relating, which will add so much depth and win the admiration of the young ones in your life. If you want your kids, if you want to have influence over your kids, the most influence you have is their high opinion of you. Never mind what punishments you can give them or what you can force them to do.
Wow. Well, as we get close to wrapping it up, I want to just have you have an opportunity to have the last word, but I have to just repeat back to you, as you've taught me to do now. What I heard was so beautiful was love, L-O-V-E, is spelt time, T-I-M-E, when it comes to parenting. And my whole focus going forward in my career, now that I'm pivoting to coaching as opposed to being a doctor, is putting kids first. I want the rest of my life to be focused on that. And with that thought in mind, or whatever else is in your heart, how do we put kids first? What would you like to share as your final most important thoughts?
It's so amazing you say that, because people always say things like, oh, the children are the future, the children are the future. Even when you go to order a pizza, they might give you a card where they say, how did you rate the service here? Is there anything we could have done to make it better? They might email you. They say, if you answer this email, you've got a chance of winning $2,500. That's how much they want the feedback of their customers. But they don't ask kids what they want out of their school. They don't ask kids what they want out of the Sunday service. They don't. So my advice to put kids first was, listen to what they have to say about their experience of life and take it seriously. Allow them to know that what they think and feel really matters to you. And that means when they grow up, they won't have all these hang-ups about getting in relationships where they're really loved, or, you know, that so many adults have. Oh, it feels so weird for someone to really love me. They won't have a problem being ambitious. They won't have a problem accepting money, because they know that their needs are important. And with that, they're more likely to be generous and giving and understanding of others' needs, because you're modeling that idea that, you know, people matter, starting with themselves.
Thank you, Anthony. That was a very beautiful wrap up, folks. Thank you for listening to this all the way through. And Anthony, I can't wait for your big project. So keep after it. I know you're writing a masterpiece. I don't know, you're in the hundreds of pages already, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, don't give up and persevere.
I definitely will. And I just want to express my appreciation for you again. And this, I love doing this show. It was one of my favorite shows so far. And just that you're I've got great admiration for you, and you're a great inspiration to me and a lot of other people there, not just from your deeds, but I think your very nature, you come across with such benevolence. And I think that's also inspiring. It reminds us of how charming benevolence is and how important it is to enter the world with coming from a loving place. And thank you for being a model for that.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.